and it's going to be from the outline. You can see it's going to be about mostly about hydrodynamics. It's not going to be much of string theory here, but you know, you guys asked me to talk about this at the string theory group meeting, so it's burden is on you. of course, the reason is there has been some connection between ADS-CFT and hydrodynamics that proved to be quite fruitful, both for ADS-CFT and for hydrodynamics itself. And so that's hopefully why it's going to be of some interest here. So I'm going to be talking about hydrofluctuations. So what is fluctuations? Fluctuations just basically means that if you're sitting in a complete thermal equilibrium, this thermal equilibrium is not actually a state where nothing happens. Because in that state, fluctuations happen. And these fluctuations, they actually do something. And what they do are changes, are the macroscopic description of that state. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. And just to make sure that I'm not telling much of new things here, the physical phenomena I'm going to be talking about is actually quite well known in the community of people who work on non-equilibrium many-body physics, condensed matter physics. In the context of relativistic quantum field theories, this phenomenon only started to be discussed recently. But for non-relativistic physics, everything I'm talking about, I'm going to be talking about, is quite well known. So I'll start by talking about hydrofluctuations a little bit. And last time, Alex wrote on the board this beautiful, maybe not so beautiful, equations of relativistic hydrodynamics. And they're complex. These relativistic Navier-Stokes equations, they're much more nasty than non-relativistic Navier-Stokes equations. I don't want to deal with those nasty equations that Alex wrote down on the board last time. I want to simplify my life as much as possible. So what I want to do, I take those equations and I linearize them. Look at small fluctuations around the static thermal equilibrium state. Moreover, I'm going to make my life as simple as possible. So I look at the state with zero charge density in equilibrium, okay? No chemical potential. Of course, in non-relativistic fluid dynamics, it makes no sense to do so. But in relativistic fluid dynamics, it makes perfect sense because zero density in equilibrium simply means number of particles is equal to the number of antiparticles. So there can be interesting collective behavior there. So there are two hydrodynamic variables now. One is the energy density. Think about this as T00 of the energy momentum tensor. One is momentum density, which I call pi. Think about this as T0i. And you know, they obey this system of equations, which again, you just get simply by linearizing, you know, your relativistic hydro equations, but this is very simple. It just tells you about the energy conservation, you know, momentum, our density is the current for the energy density. This tells you about the momentum conservation. And you know, there's this viscous stress contains shear viscosity, bulk viscosity. And you solve these linearized hydro equations, and you find that there are two modes. One mode is the transverse mode. Transverse means transverse with respect to the direction of the spatial momentum. So transverse mode is this diffusive type of behavior. Its frequency goes as k squared. And there is a longitudinal mode where both the energy density and the longitudinal momentum density oscillate. It has this kind of sound dispersion relation. And so what happens here is this. So you see, this is a longitudinal mode. You take a membrane, you start to move it like this. That's how you excite sound, with this linear dispersion relation. On the other hand, you take your membrane, start to move it like this, you excite this shield. But the point is, see, the frequency of this mode, it goes to zero as momentum goes to zero. That's the whole point of hydrodynamics. So there are these long-lived modes predicted by hydro. okay. So this is the picture about the modes. Now I want to say something about these coefficients, the viscosity coefficients that sit in those constitutive relations. Viscosity has a long history, goes back to Maxwell, who actually measured viscosity himself in addition to computing viscosity from what is now known as kinetic theory. So in kinetic theory, viscosity is proportional to the mean free path. And one way to understand this is to take a layer of a fluid. You probably can see this very well. There is this yellow arrow is supposed to represent fluid moving from right to left. And viscosity tells you about the equilibration rate between different layers of this fluid. So a particle goes from here to here. This particle comes from a fast-moving layer, goes up, carries its x momentum with it. It speeds up this layer. This particle comes down. This particle has a smaller x momentum, so it slows down this lower layer. So this is how you can see that the momentum transfer will be more effective when the mean free path is large. And you know, mean free path is inversely proportional to the cross section, inversely proportional to a coupling constant if you were to do it in a weakly coupled quantum field theory.
And so, rho then is the rest mass density?
What's the word?
The rho in your theta equal to rho v.
In non-relativistic system, this would be simply mass density. But in relativistic systems, this would be some scale in this temperature. Some, I don't know, think about this, entropy density.
So
it would
be proportional to E plus P.
E plus P, Well, this was very simple. Now, what I said on the first slide is I said that there are now these collective excitations, the sound waves, the shear waves. And now that we know these collective excitations are there, we know they're there because you can hear me speak, because you know sound waves are real, you know that this momentum transfer, it can also be achieved by these collective excitations, not only by elementary particles, you know, particles in a gas, but also by sound waves. And so you can take the same picture and now replace these straight lines with wiggly lines. Again, this is just a cartoon. I'm just giving a big picture. I'm not giving any detailed, sophisticated mathematical prescription here. But if you think about an element of a fluid, which sits right here, for example, this element of a fluid is going to be in local thermal equilibrium. Now, in local thermal equilibrium, there are fluctuations. These fluctuations mean that whatever can be excited, thermally excited in equilibrium, it will be excited. And because sound waves can be excited by thermal fluctuations, they will be excited. And therefore, there are going to be sound waves generated pretty much in every little element of the fluid. They will travel in all possible directions, and they will transfer momentum with them. And therefore, the sound waves themselves, they will contribute to the equilibration of this flow. So they will contribute to viscosity. If you try to estimate what this contribution is, well, again, so viscosity is proportional to the mean free path of whatever carries momentum. So the mean free path now, so it's inversely proportional to k squared. And if you want to sum over all these possible excitations, so integrate over d3k, because you have to sum over all possible momenta of your sound waves, well, the mean free path goes as k squared. This integral has to be cut off in the uv, of course, because hydrodynamics is only valid for very, very small k, not for large k. But then you get some kind of contribution to viscosity, which you can see is proportional to 1 over viscosity. It's kind of funny. Right? So viscosity has two contributions. One contribution is what you thought was your viscosity. The other contribution is whatever you find from the sound waves. If we look at this function, the total viscosity, it has eta naught plus something that goes 1 over eta naught. Thinking, huh, this kind of looks funny. If you have a function which goes as x plus 1 over x, well, this function has a minimum. And you may think that the total viscosity is actually going to be bounded from below, which, again, the physics is very simple. The physics is just what I said, because there are always sound waves in thermal equilibrium. There is always going to be some contribution to viscosity from those sound waves. Again, so this is completely non-specific to any details of the microscopic theory. All right, so this is the first lesson. So you may think there's going to be some kind of bound on the total shear viscosity from these hydro fluctuations. And the second point that you can take from this calculation is that, so there was this d3k here. So what happens if you do this in two spatial dimensions? Two spatial dimensions, well, this integral is going to be log divergent. And so if the integral is log divergent, actually in the infrared, so this means something bad is going to happen to the very notion of hydrodynamics in the infrared. So I actually think that hydrodynamics actually does not exist in two spatial dimensions. And this is more or less correct. And so for the rest of the talk, I'm going to kind of comment on these two points. How do these fluctuations change viscosity in three dimensions? What happens to second order hydrodynamics? Actually, turns out they do quite a lot of damage to second order hydrodynamics. What happens in two spatial dimensions? Are there any questions?
So when you do, so if you go back, when you write down this formula, there is one for A plus one, right? So you're making some assumption about the density, for example.
Wait, there is some assumption there, that's right.
So what are those assumptions? So the mean free pass is pretty much comes from the attenuation of the sound waves.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm asking at the end of the day, is there any phase factors in the
day? Any what?
Is there any K dependence? What's the number density of sound waves are inside? Does that have, in some sense, you're assuming that doesn't
matter? No, it does.
But that doesn't change the story.
It does, because the energy depends with k, and how much a given wave is excited is determined, like essentially you can think about this as a Boltzmann wave. But you're right. So there is some assumption which is sitting here somehow in the background, which is to say, if the effect I'm claiming to exist is somehow small compared to the original effect, you can perhaps trust it. But if it is large, then you have to look at scattering of sound waves with themselves and with themselves and with themselves and do some kind of resummation of this hydrodynamic perturbation theory, which I haven't done. So I'm only going to be talking about, if you wish, one loop hydrodynamic corrections, not any kind of hydrodynamic resonations.
So what is the key max in your integral? It's not supposed to be some cutoff, I'm not supposed to think about that as
something. It's the cutoff which determines the momentum above which hydrodynamics stops making sense. So it's the inverse mean free path in a weakly coupled theory. This will be something like 1 over temperature in a strongly coupled CFT. But it's basically some kind of notion of the mean free path. Or you can think about this. This is the momentum that you estimate from requiring that the one derivative terms are much smaller than zero derivative terms. Two derivative terms are much smaller than one derivative terms.
I asked the question in a slightly different way, which is, it seems to me all you were doing was presenting some suggestive arguments, and you're going to do it properly now.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Well, I'm not going to do it like super properly, but I'm going to do it better.
Okay.
That's right.
one consequence of this seems to be that the idea of a perfect fluid doesn't really make sense.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so I wanted to write a couple of, write down a couple of formulas in addition to the pictures that I showed. So the physical effect that I was talking about is essentially comes because of the interaction between hydrogen modes, right? So there was one hydrodynamic mode, which is represented by this big yellow kind of flow. So this is one hydro mode. There is a second hydro mode, which is represented by this wiggly blue line. And essentially, the effects that I'm talking about, they come from the non-linearities of hydrodynamics. And so whatever sits here, like one way to think about what describes this process is some kind of quote-unquote vertex, which I'll get to it later, but you can think about some kind of vertex which tells about the interaction of different hydro modes. And where this comes from, well, you need to look at the equations of hydrodynamics. And of course, there's going to be this nonlinear term, one obvious nonlinear term in hydro equations. There's also going to be this convective term, so on. There are also others. So it's the presence of these terms, the nonlinear terms, that lead to this effect. And this interaction of hydro modes, it was known in many body physics since late 1960s. So people used to call it mode-mode coupling. Sometimes people still call it mode-mode coupling. I'll give you one simple kind of heuristic argument of how to look at this. So you start with hydrodynamics of a simple particle flow. So take a number density current. Think about baryon number density, your favorite current. Well, the current has this diffusive contribution here, because it just tells you if you have more particles here than here, there's going to be some current flowing there. It has this convective term. Number density times velocity also contributes to current. And if you look at current-current correlation function at zero momentum, there is going to be a contribution that comes from this term, but also something from this term. And if you look at whatever happens due to this term, some kind of nv times nv correlation function, then you have to say how exactly you're going to average over how exactly we're going to take this average in equilibrium state. And you assume that your fluctuations are Gaussian. And so you can factorize this into the product of two correlation functions. Well, this one, the first one, you already know what it is. It's just the basic diffusion type decay in time. This one is, again, diffusion type decay in time because of the shear waves. Right? And then you can easily do this integral. And you get 1 over t to the power of u. So this tells you that the decay of this current-current correlation function is in fact non-exponential at finite temperature. It's not exponential, it's power law, 1 over t to the power d over 2. Now, that's not how this power law decay was discovered. It was actually discovered first in numerical simulations of billiard ball gases. And only then people kind of, you know, thought a bit and said, oh, that's how actually it comes about. So you can also, you know, Fourier transform this in time. So you get in three special dimensions, you get your current-current correlation function at long, at small frequency goes as square root of frequency. In two special dimensions, there's a log. Which you already see there's going to be some kind of problem with SCUBA formulas and so on in two special dimensions. So if you think about the SCUBA formulas, let's say for the diffusion constant, so the SCUBA formula for the diffusion constant just basically tells you how to compute this these parameters in your hydrodynamic description from the microscopic correlation functions of the operators in your quantum theory. And so for the diffusion constant, the relation is just basically current-current correlation function at zero momentum. So if you think about your long-time tails, well, so that's how your diffusion constant is going to look like in three special dimensions. So when you take omega to zero limit, this term goes away. Diffusion constant is well defined. In two special dimensions, there's going to be a log. You take omega goes to zero, so your diffusion constant is actually not well defined. And the same works for shear viscosity. Shear viscosity is going to be well defined in three special dimensions. It's not well defined in two special dimensions. So, in two special dimensions, transport coefficients blow up. Is this a problem? Or how do we think about it? Well, it actually is, so we need to deal with it. If you think about ADS-CFT, as many people who were involved in computing these transport coefficients from ADS-CFT, myself included, these log corrections are actually not visible. They're suppressed by various powers of 1 over n in the bulk. They come from they come from string loops, not from classical gravity, supergravity. So these transport coefficients, they come out finite in 3 plus 1 dimensional classical gravity, but quantum corrections to classical gravity, they're actually responsible for these very effects. They were actually worked out by Omid Saraimi and Simon Caron-Cohen a couple of years ago. And one way you can think about this is that it's an example where long time limit does not compute this large limit. So take planar limit first, all of these effects I'm going to talk about disappear. Now, if you keep n large and finite and wait long enough, then these effects are going to be there. Well, okay, so you can do the same calculation in momentum space. Okay, so you see I'm starting to draw diagrams there. So we'll come slowly going to build up the mathematical formalism. Say energy momentum TXY TXY correlation function in momentum space just comes from product of propagators. These propagators will include sound waves and shear waves for you. And you can see what this correlation function looks like. You can compute this loop integrals. That's what you get. So what happens in this formula? Okay. So this is the first term. This is the good old shear viscosity that you probably know. So this is the one that people computed from ADS-CFT in classical supergravity. There's also this term. So this term is the one that I advertised on the second or third slide. So that's the one that goes as 1 over the shear viscosity. So this gamma essentially is the shear viscosity divided by entropy density. So this correction goes 1 over the shear viscosity. Proportional to this cutoff of the hydrodynamic theory. So this is the contribution of sound waves and shear waves that feed back into the shear viscosity itself. And this term here has this omega to the 3 halves. So this is this non-analytic behavior that tells you about the power law decay of your correlation functions of the energy momentum tensor. And if you do a large n counting or small coupling counting, then you'll see that actually these red terms, they're going to be suppressed compared to this black term at either small coupling or at large n.
What does n mean?
N, if you think about a large n gauge theory, in the top limit. Actually, the same will be true in vector models. Not just in matrix.
So you did the calculation in the ADS-CFT? I don't understand.
The calculation is done in hydrodynamics, so it doesn't really care whether you do it a strongly coupled field theory or weakly coupled field theory. whether it is an ideal gas or liquid, it doesn't really care. It's done entirely in the context of hydrodynamics. But what I'm saying, if you now take this general calculation and say, what is it going to look like for a gauge theory in the Toft limit of large N, then you know exactly how thermodynamic parameters and transport coefficients scale with N. And you can just look at the scaling and see what would happen. But this result, it doesn't really care about the microscopic.
So this is now a gauge theory.
No. This result is for any n, right? So doesn't really have to be a gauge
the
theory.
This
result can be for a gas of billiard balls.
But then n would be what? Would it be the number of billiard balls?
N is in gamma eta naught. So that seems it's proportional to the entropy density.
So this will be the number of colors of billiard balls, if you wish.
Okay. Yes.
So that's where scaling comes, obviously.
But the only reason I brought up large N is because probably people are more familiar with large N or large NQCD. I mean, this does apply to large NQCD already. But what I'm saying, it's more general than that, because calculation was not done in QCD. Calculation was done in hydrodynamics, which is a lower energy limit of not just QCD, but of a whole bunch of things. All right, so
this gamma eta-naught, it was supposed to be eta-naught over E plus P.
That's right.
So, but then shouldn't N squared just cancel off from the numerator and denominator? Where is the N dependence from?
So this scale says order 1 in the large limit, but this scale says n squared. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay, so a couple of implications. So this function has a minimum. So shear viscosity is bounded from below, at least if you trust this calculation. The exact value of this minimum is actually it's not universal at all, because it does depend on the UV cutoff. Because this number here, C, depends on the UV cutoff. This cutoff, you cannot exactly say what exactly the cutoff is. You just know it has to be there, but you don't know what exactly it is. You can estimate what the cutoff is by just requiring that the derivative expansion in hydrodynamics makes sense. That is, viscous terms are smaller than the ideal terms. You know, two derivative terms are smaller than one derivative terms, and so on. So this is roughly speaking what you estimate what K-max is going to look like. And if you apply this to QCD, then you'd find this 0.016 H4.
implicitly in all this, you must be working in the small Reynolds number.
Small Reynolds number.
Because if there was turbulence, you would get an extra contribution to eta from turbulence. And then this bound could be pushed off even higher.
I think it's very steep. So if you think about how does this number compare with the numbers that people actually use in hydrodynamic simulation, so that's exactly the numbers that they use. So see here, so the viscosity kind of quote unquote bound that was proposed a number of years ago. So this was 1/4 pi. So 1/4 pi is 0.08. So this is twice that value. But again, the physics of this is very, very different from that original viscosity bound from 2004. So this physics is entirely the physics of infrared interactions of hydrodynamic waves. So it's not the physics of the microscopic details of the theory.
Okay, but you must have input N somewhere.
Huh?
You must have input N somewhere.
Oh, that's right. So this estimate was done for QCD, including the lattice data for thermodynamics of QCD. N equals 3.
Okay, so
you can talk me off and I can talk to one. But one thing that, so basically you're saying that if I have a 3+1 dimensional hydrodynamics, I have a well-defined definition of shear viscosity. However, if I take that hydrodynamics and say compactify it on a circle, then somehow the omega 3 halves will turn into a low omega term. I will not be able to define for.
I would imagine something like that.
Oh, you're going to mention that?
No, I'm not going to mention that, but I think you're right.
Okay, so is there some intuitive picture to understand why? It looks like that, you know, I have some light modes, and, you know, you're sure they can run and loop all of that, and all it is...
I mean, the only intuition that you have here is that whatever infrared effects that you have, infrared effects tend to be more severe in lower dimensions.
But I don't have to think in terms of I mean, I can think of it as a higher dimensional theory with a compactification circle, so that just makes me a gap, whatever spectrum of excitations I have. And now you are saying that sort of what I think maybe an innocent thing has this dramatic effect that now I can't even talk about shear viscosity.
Oh, you will be able to talk about it. I will tell you exactly how to talk about it.
Well, so what viscosity is perceived by some waves themselves. In the total or in the zero?
Huh? Okay, no. The viscosity that would the total no nonsense, you know, honest to God viscosity that you would measure, you know, by this kind of torsional pendulum experiment or something like that is the total viscosity.
Right. In the equations that you start with, linear equations, etc. In that equation, which viscosity should you use? Total or
I'll come to that later. But basically the point is if you use classical hydrodynamic equations as they are, so if you think your physics is described by hydrodynamics in the sense it is described by a set of classical partial differential equations, then those equations, they actually miss the physics that I'm talking about. So the physics that I'm talking about is not contained in the hydrodynamic equations as a classical set of equations. Because classical hydrodynamic equations, they don't tell you that you can, you know, excite sound waves in thermal equilibrium, and so these sound waves have, like classical equations are blind to this. So in order to actually to systematically treat this is to make your hybrid equations into stochastic equations by you know, adding noise and averaging over the noise, which is what I'm going to talk about next.
Yeah, sure. But just for this argument, it was very important.
That's right. So the total no nonsense measurable viscosity is the total viscosity. No.
That's frequency dependent.
Yeah, it is.
So you mean at the zero frequency?
It depends on the experiment, but yeah, zero frequency limit.
Okay. I mean, maybe it's the same answer, but if my experiment, instead of the one you mentioned, was watching a sound wave decay away, that in your dispersion relation, it was the whatever on the case where it was controlling that. Is that now Ada total?
That's the total.
Okay.
But isn't it now Ada total of K?
That's right. It will depend on K.
But then the
zero
substitute Ada total in the estimate, there is no
total. Huh?
If you write the equation that Ada total is equal to Ada 0 plus 1 over Ada total,
yes, but the calculation was right. The calculation was done like the eta that sits. So what I'm saying is that the viscosity that sits in the hydrodynamic equations is not the viscosity that's going to be measured. So because hydrodynamic equations, as a set of just classical differential equations, they don't capture the whole of physics.
So if someone came and said, you know, they've done a careful analysis of the numeric data or ALICE data, and they find 8 over S is 0.11 H bar, are they wrong, or is this, you know, there's some simplifying assumption here?
I would tend to think they're wrong. But there are also assumptions here, right? Which I didn't really talk about that much. And the assumptions is that you can cleanly separate the two contributions. So there's going to be some parametric separation between this eta naught and eta one. And this parametric separation can be done at small coupling, or when coupling is, you know, small but finite, or at large n when n is large but finite. If your n is, you know, not that large, if your coupling is, you know, really order one, then I'm not quite sure.
But for instance, your discussion of k-max, I see k-max,
yeah.
That doesn't affect this result very much.
Well, it will. It will. I mean, but it will not affect it that much because, you know, this extra coefficient is just scales with k max, not with some funny power of k max. I don't know. The best answer is that I probably need to spend more time thinking about it. But I mean, I'm not hiding anything. So that's.
You're not.
I'm not hiding anything. So that's the calculation that one can do. It looks reasonable. The regime of validity, I think it can be well justified at large n or small coupling. I mean, large but finite n. If n is really not large, I start getting less sure about this.
So we'll wait until they say it's 0.11.
Someone said zero. If you were to do this for, say, water at room temperature, you say people did that actually. How big of an effect does it have on your discussion?
I haven't done this. I'm sure you can do this and estimate what it is. But again, you're not the thing that is accessible in experiment to you is a total viscosity.
Right.
What I'm saying is that the effect that I just described is really a new effect in the calculational scheme. So for example, this is not an effect that you would see in the Boltzmann equation approach to transport.
No, but in the Boltzmann equation, you don't put in viscosity at all. It's a fundamental parameter.
That's right. But you can still you can still compute things as, you know, the energy momentum tensor and the current and so on, and you will not see these terms.
But this seems to, in particular, this implies some running of the viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something you could see. In a lab
report.
That could be checked.
That's right.
So, you have an idea of the order of magnitude? Well, I guess it's
what I'm talking about, you're right, it's completely non-specific. The effect is non-specific to QCD or gauge C or whatever. It's there in water, right? It must be there in water. Now, I don't know if people have actually specifically looked for this effect. I mean, I tried to do a little bit of literature search on this. I haven't seen much, but this effect has been very well known to people in condensed matter physics since basically late 1960s. You can surely see very similar effects that involve the scaling of transport coefficients near what do you call this? Critical points. So the effects they exhibit essentially the same physics. I'm not sure about the experimental measurement of this precise running of the coefficient in two-dimensional liquids, that I'm not sure. But the effects that are essentially due to exactly the same physics, they have been observed for sure.
Shouldn't the S that you're using there also include the contribution from the sample?
That's right. It should, and it does. So in this estimate, what we did, we just took S from the lattice. When take S from the lattice, supposedly includes everything that that you can imagine.
Oh, it includes the tech from the sample.
That's right.
So where were you then? At what temperature or compared to the Roswell?
This was at about, I don't know, 2 TC.
One way maybe to think of this, so when you write down eta plus C over eta, so eta is some microscopic viscosity. And the observable one in experiment is eta plus C over eta.
Well, you can think about first eta naught is bare viscosity.
Yes.
And then, you know, 1 over eta is going to be your loop correction to the bare viscosity, which you can now call the tall thin, your renormalized viscosity, write down some kind of RG equation.
So then, in principle, those are different questions about the. But we can argue that the first one is a physical, is the bare one is bounded. Or, you know, is there a bound?
But the bare one is only defined. I would tend to say that the bare one is indeed a physical. Yeah.
So you cannot imagine any other experiment in which, you know, so if you look at some diffusive process, you see you would measure this viscosity, this coefficient, say C1. If I were to design some other experiment, I would observe a different combination of eta plus C2 over A. So in that case, I could say that in principle, by looking at different observables, I would have access to A. Or is there some way in which you want to say that?
I think there is a way. I mean, if you, like from a field theorist point of view, right, if all you have access to is correlation functions of your, you know, local operators, then surely the correlation function, the energy momentum tensor, will have the total viscosity, which includes everything regardless of the experiment used. The spectral function of the energy momentum, it's in principle measurable by, I don't know, by neutron scattering.
So you're saying in everything I will observe?
Oh, not by neutron scattering, so, but, okay.
So in some sense, everything, the physical one is, in some sense, is renormalizable, shear viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
But then there is a way of thinking in terms of effective description of the hydrodynamics. I mean, is there something that, like, I already take into account some of postulations and want to write it down as some effective description without worrying about some of fluctuations on top of them?
Well, I mean, the logic here is exactly the same logic as you have in perturbative quantum field theory, where you have, you know, Runyon masses, Runyon couplings, you know.
So there are quantum tricks, but at the end of the day, I have an effective description in terms of sort of renormalized series. But you're saying that now I cannot.
Well, what do you mean effective description in terms of renormalized parameters, right? I mean, you always.
If I have effective theory, I don't have to quantize it anymore. In some sense, what you're saying is that you're taking the hydrodynamics which is already in
I don't know. No. What do you mean you don't have to quantize anymore? Like do you want to treat QED as a classical skill theory? I don't know. It makes no sense. Right?
Yeah. Well, I compute an effective action and write it. So now, I mean, one way of thinking about hydrodynamics.
Yes, so here you would be able to compute the effective action, right?
Okay, so you're basically saying that
But this effective action contains more information than is contained in purely classical hydrodynamic equations.
You should just move on and see how it looks like instead of philosophizing over this same slide.
Okay, so I already said this, that the current simulations of the quaternion plasma are actually blind to this effect because they simply solve the classical partial differential equations and ignore these fluctuations. So this was for one derivative hydro. I don't have really time to talk much about two derivative hydro and so on, but I'll just say that if you try to see what this works for two derivative hydro, you'll see that you are in trouble, and one way to see that you're in trouble is if you look at this again retarded two-point function of the energy momentum tensor TXY computed from two derivative Israel Stewart plus other terms relativistic hydrodynamics. So it has this form basically. This is one R of frequency. This comes from one derivative hydro, relativistic Navier-Stokes equations. This has two powers of frequency, two powers of momenta. So it comes from two derivative terms in the Navier-Stokes equations, or in the corrections to the Navier-Stokes equations that are supposed to make them causal. now, this actually gets seriously modified by one loop hydro fluctuations that I was talking about, because now you have this. Okay, first term and second term, you have them all right, but there's now this omega to the 3 halves. You see, omega to the 3 halves is less important than omega, but it's more important than omega squared. And so what this tells you is that if you just blindly apply a Kuba formula for your tau pi, which is most often used transport coefficient, well, it makes no sense. You just close up. This is just simply saying that there's something that sits in here in between omega and omega squared, which the classical second order hydro does not capture. So this means tau pi, strictly speaking, does not exist in classical hydrodynamics.
What is tau pi?
Tau pi, did you talk about tau pi last time? No, you didn't. So basically, if you look at a relativistic version of Navier-Stokes equations, so you can think about them as expansion of your energy momentum tensor in terms of, it's no derivative terms, this is ideal hydro, this is one derivative term, this is viscous hydro. You can ask about, can you add two derivative terms, three derivative terms, and so on. And there's a benefit to doing this, and the benefit is this. The first benefit is that you may think that when you add these two derivative terms, you're making your theory more precise because it's a derivative expansion. So the more derivative terms you have, the more precise your theory is going to be. And the second advantage is that when you add these two derivative terms to relativistic hydrodynamics, as Israel and Stewart did in 1979, I think, this will actually make your relativistic hydrodynamics causal. Because if you don't do this, then there are problems. And the tau pi is a coefficient of one of those two derivative terms that actually that's the coefficient that Israel and Stewart introduced to make relativistic hydro causal.
So it's like the second time derivative coefficient, double time derivative
term. It has both space and time derivative. So, okay, I'll probably skip this. There's some words about second order hydro and heavy ion collisions. I want to come to this slide, which is there a hope for hydrodynamics? so So these are the questions. Is 2 plus 1 dimensional hydrodynamics completely meaningless? Is 3 plus 1 dimensional hydrodynamics meaningless beyond first derivatives? And the answer I'd like to think about this way is that hydro is actually not meaningless. And instead of just saying hydro is meaningless, it's better to think about viscosity, conductivity, and so on as scale-dependent Ronian masses in a low-energy effective hydro theory. Now, what exactly is this hydro theory? I still haven't told you what this full hydro theory is. But you know, it has got to include both dissipation, which is this transport coefficients, and fluctuations because of the thermally excited modes. But so far, the classical hydrodynamic equations, they only have dissipation but not fluctuation. So how do you have a system that has both dissipation and fluctuation? And that's what I was going to talk about next. But I don't really have much time. Okay. Well, then I'll say something about fluctuations. So, of course, the prime example of a system where you have can learn about this interplay between fluctuation and dissipation is the Brownian particle. Well, so that's the next 5 minutes or so. I'm going to talk about Brownian particles. Maybe from the point of view that you have not, that you may not necessarily have seen. Or maybe you have. So Langevin equation is just the equation of motion for the Brownian particle. Just mass times acceleration is equal to the force. Right? This is viscous force. some kind of friction coefficient proportional to the viscosity. And there is some random force, which tells you about, you know, the random force on the macroscopic particle. And if you introduce this convenient notation, q is equal to dx dt, you get what's called the Langevin equation with this noise in the right-hand side, which, well, you have to say what this is. Well, it averages to zero. It's only correlated at short distances, actually delta function correlated. This coefficient determines the strength of the noise. And the way you compute correlation functions for your velocity fields, remember q is the velocity field for the Brownian particle. So the way you compute correlation functions is very easy, is very simple. So take this Langevin equation and you solve for your velocity in terms of the noise, right? So just take this equation, see what q is in terms of the right hand side. Right? So this is you can easily do with the Green's function. You take the product of these two solutions. You average them over the noise. You know how to do this because you know the two-point function of the noise, which is the Gaussian noise. And at late times, that's what your correlation function looks like as a function of real time. That's what it looks like when you Fourier transform. So you see it has this very pretty singularity set, omega is equal to plus minus I gamma, which of course should remind you the diffusive singularities in hydrodynamics. noise strengths, probably can skip things about noise strengths. Well, okay, so what is going to determine the noise strengths? And the way to figure out what the coefficient is in the noise strengths here is just to demand that the fluctuation dissipation theorem is satisfied. It's actually pretty easy to do, but you will see that it's actually related to temperature. It's not an arbitrary number, it's related to temperature. In more complex system, it will be related to transport coefficients here, like to viscosity or diffusion constant or so. But this is all kind of the standard, you know, statistical physics, I don't know, second or third year kind of thing. So what I want to do now is I want to represent this Brownian particle as some kind of 0 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory defined by an effective action and a functional integral. Right? So it's quantum mechanics.
So do you mean a weak rotated quantum mechanics?
No,
really,
no, no.
So you want to do quantum Brownian motion?
Quantum?
quantum Brownian motion?
No, I just want to, just classical Brownian motion.
So then it's like a weak rotated 0 plus 1 dimensional theory.
You may call it this way, but you'll see in a second what.
But anyway, you're doing classical Brownian.
It's classical Brownian mode. There's nothing quantum here. Yeah, everything is classical. There are several easy steps. So step one, so you write your Langevin equation as something is equal to zero. And that's very easy to do. Step two, you have to say what exactly you mean by the noise. So the average over the noise, well, it's a Gaussian noise. So it simply means to integrate over all possible noise with some quadratic weight. Right? That's what it means to say have a Gaussian noise.
Why do you call Gaussian noise?
Makes life much easier.
It's, no, maybe it's experimentally measured. I don't know.
You know, it's one of these eternal questions. You know, whenever it's like, where does, you know, the dust come from, or like where do money go, you know, why is your noise Gauss? Like whenever you're talking about this, there will be somebody who will raise their hand and say, why is your noise Gaussian? And
is there any evidence, experimental evidence for Gauss? Is it completely classical?
No, I mean, you can mumble some verse about, you know, the central limit theorem, and you know, whenever you have a large number of random events, but if you ask me, have people actually measured the properties of the noise for the actual Brownian particles? I don't know. You're not happy.
I'm trying to learn something new for me, so okay, that's how it is.
Well, let's say it's Gaussian for now and see. Because, see, whatever I'm doing here, you can do it with any noise. Gaussian or not, I mean, you'll have to integrate it out somehow, but it's not Gaussian. And you can just keep it in your numerical simulations, it's not Gaussian. Because, like, for the purpose of my argument, it's not going to be really important. So step three is, you have these wonderful identities between delta function, you know, f of x, it's actually proportional to delta of x minus x naught, where x naught solves this equation. It's not a very deep statement. It's something everyone knows. So what this tells you, actually, is that when you have a product of several solutions to your equation of motion, the way you can achieve this is that you can take product of any functions, integrate over all possible functions, and then impose by hand the condition that your functions satisfy the equation. So I'm saying whatever satisfies the equation of motion is integral over, you know, all possible configurations times the constraint that it must satisfy the equation of motion. And it's going to be some Jacobian there coming from this variable change. And step four, you simply exponentiate this delta. And so what you see is that now all your correlation functions can be written as a functional integral over your fields and some auxiliary fields. So when the dust settles, actually a correlation function of your velocity fields for the Brownian particle is going to be equal to integral over all possible velocity fields. This P is just an auxiliary field. And you know there's going to be some action here, which is just, you know, P is the auxiliary field, Q is the velocity, F is whatever part of the Langevin equation. Again, I'm not inventing this. You can read about this in like the first or second chapter of Zinjastan's book on quantum field theory. And again, you can just use this effective action to calculate correlation functions of your field. And you get, of course, exactly the same thing as you would get from the Langevin equation in the first place. But so that's the bottom line. So take a stochastic equation. You can actually rewrite this as quote unquote field theory with this action. All right. So now I want to do exactly the same thing, but for hydrodynamics.
But before you look, how does fluctuation dissipation theorem it constrains C in some way?
So it constrains C, that's right.
So should I think of this as a constant? So I mean, C, in your previous case, it depended only on the temperature. So it looked like to me it depends on the state.
It sure does.
Right. So how should I, every time I do the computation, I have to keep it? So in principle, it's a function that depends on your equilibrium parameters.
That's right. Okay. So like somewhere in the background, what goes on here is that you're assuming that you're looking at fluctuations in thermal equilibrium. That's right.
Right, small fluctuations in thermal equilibrium.
Because I mean,
and that's saying that's an additional condition that whenever you compute this correlation functions, you have to impose.
That's right. But that's right. Yeah. But of course, the stochastic process can be defined for any C, and you know, for any kind of noise.
But if you screw up the C, then you get some weird properties.
You get weird properties, but it simply means that what you are describing is not fluctuations in equilibrium. You are describing something else.
But eventually, you're gonna sell this as a proper way of thinking about thermal fluctuations in equilibrium.
That's right.
So then I don't have much choice, but you better get that thing right.
Which?
Well, I mean, eventually, if I want to sort of take S for the hydrodynamics and then do the computations and compare this experiment, I will get nonsense unless I make C agree with fluctuation dissipation.
That's right. So what you can do is that you can demand that your noise locally looks like the noise in thermal equilibrium. That's right. Because that's kind of the whole assumption of hydrodynamics of local equilibration. And so you would know what noise looks like in the local rest frame of the fluid, and then you can just use Lorentz invariance to figure out what it looks like in any frame.
Can I ask just a quick question? Why do you take the next step and T as a Gaussian integral to whatever you need to do that?
You can. You can do this. It's not a problem at all. I didn't do this in this slide. So what will happen in hydrodynamics is that there's not going to be just a P, there's going to be a kinetic term for P. So when you integrate it, out the action for your hydrodynamic variables is going to be non-local. But that's okay. So what I want to say is that there is this very simple procedure how to convert stochastic equations to functional integrals. So I want to do now exactly the same thing for hydrodynamics. I want to take my equations of hydrodynamics and random stresses and random currents to the right-hand side of my conservation of the energy momentum tensor and the current, and find out the effective action for hydrodynamics. That is, I want to actually take hydrodynamics not as a set of classical partial differential equations, but as an actual field theory. We integrate over all possible hydrodynamic fields to have some action in the exponential. So I'm not going to tell you the full story how this is done for full relativistic hydro. But I'm going to tell about a simpler story, especially because I don't have time. It doesn't feel like okay. Just skip through diffusion, model A, model B, blah, blah, blah. Do this in linear hydrodynamics. Well, okay, so I'll just tell you the answer for linear hydrodynamics. So the linear hydrodynamics, which is what you get if you just take your relativistic Navier-Stokes equations, expand in small fluctuations around the equilibrium state. you can ask, what is the effective action that would actually reproduce you your hydrodynamic response functions? Because you know there are all the sound waves and shear waves. If you look at the correlation functions of the energy momentum tensors, there's going to be singularities corresponding to sound waves and shear waves. What is the action that reproduces these correlation functions for you? Right. So if you look at textbooks or old review papers on hydrodynamics. This is the action. This is the correlation function of momentum density. Think about this two-point function of T0i, symmetrized in some equilibrium. Or think about this as the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function. Well, that's what it looks like. That's what you can compute in the standard linear response theory. It has singularities corresponding to sound waves, singularity corresponding to the shear wave. So you can ask, can you get this from some kind of action? Can you write down the Gaussian action that would reproduce this two-point function for you?
So what's omega
bar? Oh, W bar, it's enthalpy, energy density plus pressure. And you can, by doing exactly the same procedure that I outlined earlier, by adding the random stresses to the right-hand side of the conservation of the energy momentum tensor. So this is the effective action, which will reproduce these linearized hydro correlation functions for you. Well, it's a mess. Well, it's not a big mess, but it's a little bit of a mess. This ed is just an auxiliary field. Okay, that's easy. So this one just enforces the conservation of energy. Right, okay, so this one is also an auxiliary field. This just, again, enforces this hydrodynamic equation for conservation of momentum. Now there is some kinetic term for the auxiliary field. I have to tell you what this M matrix is. This M matrix, I had somewhere in the previous slide, somewhere here. Oh yeah, it's just this. This differential operator. It's not illuminating. This coefficient proportional to the shear viscosity. This is a combination of shear and bulk viscosities here. Basically, some second order differential operator. And it's not exactly important what it is. But that's the action. So it has some kinetic term for the auxiliary field. It has this auxiliary field. It's coupled to your momentum density field and to the energy density field. You can integrate out the auxiliary fields. You get a completely real but non-local action. This E is just momentum density, energy density, so on. D is the inverse of the second order differential operator. But that's the action. So that's the action which will tell you, which will produce for you exactly those hydrodynamic correlation functions.
If you go one page back, so you're introducing a source only to the momentum transport equation.
That's right.
That means the sort of fluctuations. But why not to the energy as well?
Well, that's exact, right? So that's exact. There's going to be no dissipation in this relation. That's basically a definition. So this is T0, this is T0i. Right? So regardless of, that's always going to be true. So there's no approximation in this equation. Unlike in this one, where you actually approximate your spatial stress, with this derivative expansion in terms of shear viscosity and bulk viscosity and so on.
Another way to say this is that
this and this is in relativistic hydro is actually one and the same variable that sits that is both a source for the energy current. Energy current is equal to momentum density. That's only true in relativistic theories. In non-relativistic hydrodynamics, energy current will be different from momentum density. And in non-relativistic hydro, there will be actually extra terms here, which will tell about the dissipation in the energy current. All right, so you can do this effective action for linearized hydro, reproduce correlation functions. So this effective action, just to make sure, this effective action is actually not meant to reproduce the classical hydro equation. It's not the action that gives the equations for you. It's the action that is to be thought of as providing a generating functional or correlation functions of hydrodynamic fields. So it's just to be used to construct the generating functional for the correlation functions of T, zero mu, at low energies in real time near thermal equilibrium. So the goal is not just to take the variation of the action and derive the hydro equations. Like, we already know the hydro equation. There's not much point to deriving them from some kind of action. But we really want to get a handle on this hydro fluctuations. So that's why that effective action is, I think, is useful. So this was for linear hydro. Right? You know how to construct the effective action for linear hydro? And look at the full nonlinear hydro. Yeah.
So if I don't do nonlinear hydro, but do what you have and compute, will I reproduce your in this linearized effective action approach by computing one with your
methods? No, linearized hydro doesn't do it. I mean, all this mode coupling comes from nonlinear.
So this one doesn't do anything compared to classical hydro. This way of rewriting.
No, it doesn't.
Because
it doesn't. But I thought it's a cool way to rewrite. I mean, you can probably derive it from ADS. I mean, this action you can probably derive by playing with ADS Schwarzschild.
But is that since you're saying this, let's go back.
Okay.
So there is an assumption about the properties of the noise, right?
Yep.
And how universal are your results? I guess I'm asking, is that the unique way of writing down?
This noise is the noise, if you believe it's Gaussian.
I'm happy to believe that it's Gaussian.
That's the only noise that's consistent with the fluctuation dissipation.
Okay.
All right. Now, I will not tell you how to do it in the full nonlinear hydro, because that's still work in progress. It's kind of ugly. But I will tell you about a toy model. A toy model that kind of has similar features. I think it actually has all of the same features. It's a model from 1977, Forster, Ness, and Steven. It's basically conserved current coupled to the energy momentum tensor, and you impose this incompressibility condition. So that's the simplifying assumption. Just impose it by hand. Throw away the sound waves. Sound waves are high energy modes compared to the shear waves. So that's just a model, a toy model. And there are these nonlinear terms which couple your momenta, couple your charge density with momentum density. And to make it into a stochastic model, you add noises here, and can follow through exactly the same procedure as I outlined 10 minutes ago, and figure out what the effective action is going to be for this model. Now, why am I doing this model? Now, the reason I'm doing this model is I want to have nonlinearities. As Alex pointed out, you need to have nonlinearities. You need to have interactions between hydro modes in order to see this effects of fluctuations. So these are my interactions. This is the usual convective term, number density times velocity. This is the usual nonlinear terms from the relativistic hydro. You know, T mu nu has the term which is proportional to U mu U nu. So that's this term here. And yeah, so that's the model.
Sorry, can I ask just a quick question? So is incompressible fluid different from compressible conformal fluid? I guess would there be a difference anywhere if I'm not opposing this condition, but rather imposing this condition that I have a conformal fluid? What do you mean conformal fluid? Well, at least to first order in derivative expansion, this guy is coupled.
Oh, you mean hydrodynamics over CFT? Is this what you mean?
Yeah.
No, it's going to be different. Because the difference is that this condition really kills sound waves. Because sound waves are longitudinal. And so you automatically throw away sound waves by this condition here. So this only keeps the shear waves and the diffusion waves.
Okay.
So that's the simplified assumption. All right. So you can follow the same procedure. Find some effective action. I mean, I just wanted to show it. It's kind of lengthy, but you know, you can do it. There's quadratic term, interaction term. There's going to be a couple of auxiliary fields. There's going to be a couple of ghost fields. Because you know, you have this Jacobian there when you know you did this variable change. And, you know, you exponentiate the Jacobian with the ghost fields. Some constraints here, but basically that's just a Lagrangian. You can do your favorite, you know, diagrammatic analysis of correlation functions here.
Sorry,
yeah.
I don't know who will kill me first, you or the other people. If you are doing an incompressible fluid, why are we talking about this before? The whole story of why are we talking this is because there is an extra transport that contributed to the shear viscosity, and that transport was due to the sound waves.
No, not only sound waves. Sound waves and shear waves. Both sound waves. The reason I said sound waves is because sound waves is easier to convey what it is, but it's both sound waves and shear waves.
But shear waves don't propagate.
They don't propagate, but they contribute.
They still contribute.
I mean,
yeah.
They propagate, but they decay.
Yeah,
but, yeah so they contribute to the viscosity in exactly the same way as the sound waves. Can compute your correlation functions, you know, the energy momentum tensor and the current. And they kind of look like, you know, the correlation functions you know already from before. The only difference is that this shear viscosity here, diffusion constant here, they will depend on frequency in this kind of funny non-analytic way. Square root. Now this square root is exactly the same omega to the 3/2 that I was talking about. It's exactly the same. Except here you can explicitly see this by just doing an honest loop diagram in an honest quantum field theory. And you know, conventional Kubo formulas make sense. You know, take limit omega goes to zero, you know, all these fluctuation effects disappear. Now, on the other hand, if you're in two spatial dimensions, then there are these log terms. And because of these log terms, if you demand that your correlation function is actually insensitive to this arbitrary scale that sits here in the logs, actually discover that your shear viscosity and the diffusion constant are Runyon masses that obey this one loop RG equations. This capital gamma is just the shear viscosity. So you can take these equations and see what is the flow diagram going to look like. And it's going to look like this. So this is diffusion constant times square root of s. Well, square root of s is not the center of mass energy. It's square root of entropy density. The viscosity divided by t times square root of s. And the arrows here point towards the infrared, small frequency. So what you see is the extreme low frequency limit. All of these curves here, they asymptote to this line here, which you can figure out what it is. It's square root of 17 minus 1 over 2. So this tells you that in the extreme infrared, this dt is actually going to be proportional to at over S. So this tells you that actually your D and eta are not independent transport coefficients in the extreme. They're actually one and the same. I was very excited when I derived this. But then I looked at lecture notes by Vladimir Lebedev, who is a Russian physicist who has worked on this for a while. And he has this as an exercise for the reader in his lecture notes.
Are you saying there's no RFD flow in 3 plus 1?
Well, it's not a, because I mean there are square roots, there are no logs. So I mean you know exactly what this. I mean you can probably think about this as RFD flow, but it's a power. It's not a log. Okay, so conclusions. Okay, so the viscosity over entropy seems to be bounded below in actual QCD. Second order hydro, strictly speaking, does not exist. I mean, strictly speaking, does not exist as a classical theory. Everything is fine once you include the noise. Second order hydro is actually going to be okay for large at over S. I didn't talk about this, but you can read about this in our paper with Guy Moore and Paul Marshkin. If the viscosity is very, very small, then there are actually severe problems with second order hydro. If the viscosity is sufficiently large, it's okay. Fluctuation effects that disappear in the large and limit. There are also all these kind of open questions that are randomly listed on the slide. The full nonlinear relativistic hydro with noises work out all this. Effective action stuff, I mean, it's work in progress right now. It should be possible to derive these effective actions from ADS CFT. You can do this for superfluids, do non-zero density magnetic field, look at other second order coefficients, not just tau pi. I don't know, just a random list of questions that I wrote down here. And that's pretty much it. Yeah, thanks.
There were already many questions. For one question. Anybody has a question? Okay. So if not, let's thank Pavel again.